Victims of clashes with Azerbaijan as the opposition kept up pressure on the country's leader to resign over the handling of the conflict. More than 5,000 people, including civilians, were killed in Armenia and Azerbaijan when clashes erupted between the ex-Soviet enemies in late September over the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh. The war ended in November with a peace agreement that saw the Russia-allied Armenians cede parts of territory to Azerbaijan, which is backed by Turkey. The deal sparked fury in Armenia, with the opposition urging the prime minister to resign. On the first day of national mourning on Saturday, Armenia's prime minister was expected to lead a procession to a memorial complex in the capital city, where victims of the conflict are buried. The opposition planned to hold a separate march later in the day. More than 300 schoolboys kidnapped last week in an attack on their school in northwest Nigeria have arrived in the capital of Katsina State after their release on Thursday. Friends and family gathered to greet the boys with tears and hugs as they arrive. The boys were abducted 1 week ago from the all-boys government science secondary school in Kankara in Katsina State. Nigeria's Boko Haram jihadist rebels claim responsibility for the abduction, saying they attacked the school because it believes Western education is un-Islamic, factional leader Abubakar Shekau said in a video earlier this week. More than 800 students were at the school at the time of the attack. Hundreds escaped, but over 300 boys were taken. They told authorities this week that they had been beaten by their captors and forced to march through the forest as government forces pursued them. This is VOA News, and here are some of the latest developments in the global coronavirus crisis. Italy, one of the country's worst hit by COVID-19, will be classified a red zone over the Christmas and New Year periods, meaning that between December 21st and January 6th, people will only be allowed to leave their homes once a day to visit friends or relatives, and travel between regions will be banned. And starting from December 24th, bars and restaurants will also be closed. However, the rules will be relaxed on December 28th, 29th, and 30th, as well as on January 4th, when shops will remain open until 9 p.m. and people can move about freely. Swiss regulators gave the green light to the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, with immunization set to start within days as the country battles rising coronavirus cases and deaths. It is the first COVID-19 vaccine approved in the wealthy Alpine nation, but others are being assessed. The Swiss health minister says vaccinations will start in the coming days, with the most vulnerable having priority. The United States authorizes Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use as the country grapples with a surge that is killing over 2,500 people a day. The U.S. is the first nation to approve the two-dose regimen, which is now the second vaccine to be deployed in a Western country after one developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. At least 9 coronavirus patients died in a fire at a hospital in southeastern Turkey, the health ministry says. The blaze in an intensive care ward of the hospital broke out when a tank on an artificial respirator exploded. All the victims were patients who had been hospitalized with the coronavirus. Turkey has recorded more than 1.9 million cases of COVID-19 and more than 17,600 deaths since the pandemic began a year ago. Australia's Sydney to Hobart yacht race is called off for the first time in its 76-year history because of an escalating coronavirus outbreak, organizers are saying. The often brutal 628 nautical mile race was due to start on Boxing Day, just after Christmas. But with parts of Sydney locked down after a new cluster of COVID-19 cases, the race has been canceled. At least 1.6 million people have died since the outbreak of COVID-19 emerged in China last December. That's according to tallies from Johns Hopkins University. For more on these and other international news stories, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Boomen, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman, Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Joe Biden has won again. By that, we mean that on Monday, December 14th, the members of the Electoral College met in all 50 states here in Washington, D.C., and the vote, as expected, perfectly reflected the results of the nationwide election on November 3rd. President Donald Trump was defeated and will have to leave office next month, but we'll talk about continuing controversy over that. Some Trump officials have been leaving government service, among them the Attorney General William Barr. He had a falling out with the president, but Barr's resignation letter was full of praise for Mr. Trump. We'll talk about that. And we're sorry to say the coronavirus crisis continues all around the world. In many countries, including here in the United States, it's worse than ever. Even as vaccines were developed amazingly quickly, and the jabs or inoculation shots have begun. Let's turn to Tom DeFrank first on U.S. politics. In the Electoral College, where each state is winner take all, here's how it added up. Joe Biden got 306, Donald Trump 232. So now some senior Republicans are admitting that their candidate, President Trump, was defeated. But he is not conceding defeat. And Tom, President Trump probably never will admit that he lost.
I think that's right, Dan. I do not believe the C word, as in concession, is in his dictionary. I just don't think he can do it. His whole personality is about winning. He hates losers. He loves winners. Remember when he was campaigning, he said 4 years ago that we're going to be winning so much, you, the country, will be sick of how much winning we're going to do. So the notion that he would ever kind of graciously admit that he lost and move on is fairly far-fetched. It's not even clear at this point whether he will attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th, which if he does not, would be a real breach of democratic protocol, at least in our democratic system. So I don't think he'll ever concede. I don't think he's going to invite Biden to the White House. I just don't think he's made to do that. And I think it's probably not a smart thing for the president, short term or long term. And we'll just see how it plays out. But Joe Biden is the next president. And at this point, there should be no doubt about that.
Well, at 12 o'clock noon here in Washington on January 20th, Joe Biden officially becomes president. He will be sworn in. That is planned for the usual site on Capitol Hill at the Capitol building. The parades and other celebrations will be scaled back because of the coronavirus. But Emily Tamkin, should anyone have any concern that the Trump family, led by the president, of course, might not leave the White House?
There was a report that said that idea was floated at one point within Trump's circle in the White House and that he was talked out of it. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility. I think more likely is that he does leave at some point and continues to claim that the results are wrong and that actually he won, and perhaps hold a rally on Inauguration Day, something to try to keep the focus on him that will be less obviously humiliating to him than being dragged out of the White House on January 20th.
Well, there's still a very big political fight in the state of Georgia. It's very unusual. Both seats in the U.S. Senate are up for grabs in a special election, and folks there have through January 5th to vote. If Democrats win both those seats, Democrats, meaning the new president Joe Biden, will control the U.S. Senate, though just barely. Now, the Republicans hold both of those seats. The incumbents, the current senators, seem favored to win, Tom DeFrank. It would be very surprising if the Democrats could capture both those seats.
Very surprising, Dan. Very surprising, but it is not beyond the realm of possibility. And it's interesting, we'll talk about this later, probably about stimulus programs and the state of the economy, but But Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who has been holding back on bringing an economic relief aid package to the floor of the Senate, has changed his tune. And the reason he's giving Republicans is that our two senators, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, are getting, quote, hammered on the issue of no stimulus legislation for millions of people around the country who are in need, but especially in Georgia. So that's a wild card, but I agree. Conventionally speaking, I'd be surprised if the Democrats pick up both of those seats. If they pick up one, that's not enough to control the Senate. They have to pick up both.
Let's look at any long-term changes here in U.S. politics. Emily, you write for a British-based publication, The New Statesman, readers all around the world, and they're trying to figure out the United States. Have you been suggesting that the usual battle lines between Democrats and Republicans have been changed, perhaps forever, by the 4 years of Donald Trump?
I think that battle lines between the parties, that is, who holds what view on any given issue, I think that those are always changing. And one party will support X and the other Y, and then 8 years later it will reverse. But what I have been suggesting, and actually just saying, is that I do think that politics in this country has been changed by the last 4 years. I think that Donald Trump's party, in a way, I think that there are many people who are now modeling themselves off of him coming up in the Republican Party. And the Democratic Party has changed too. You know, Biden is obviously the most powerful person in the Democratic Party and will soon be the most powerful person in the country. But there is a huge chunk of the party that doesn't see eye to eye with him, and further, that doesn't want to go back to politics as usual either. So this is a long-winded way of saying that less than policy changes or battle lines, I think that our very understanding of politics and power in this country has shifted.
Our very understanding of politics. I mean, still, we have a democracy where the members of Congress are elected by the various districts and states around the country. The president, of course, is elected, though now we have disputes over that. And there's that third branch of government, the judiciary, where President Trump was lucky, you might say, that three vacancies developed on the Supreme Court, and he was able to fill those. Absolutely a long-term change. Tom DeFrank, when we think about the 4 years of Donald Trump, I mean, he was very unconventional and different. Do you think it has an eternal impact?
Eternal is a long time, Dan, but I think it's fair to say that his reshaping of the federal courts, and especially the Supreme Court, will have a very long-lasting impact. The three conservative judges on the Supreme Court now means there are twice as many conservative justices on that court than there are liberals, and that's going to take a generation to change. So that, I think, is a very long-lasting, but it won't be eternal. With every Supreme Court justice who retires or dies, steps down for medical reasons, whatever, the balance will change as long as Joe Biden is president, and it depends on your political point of view. For better or worse, that will probably be Trump's lasting achievement. The other problem is the polarization, the lack of bipartisanship over the last 4 years is going to take a while to get fixed as well. But the Supreme Court and his federal judicial appointments will be the most long-lasting legacy of the Trump years.
At least two of the challenges filed by President Trump's supporters challenging the vote counts in some of the states in the November election, at least two of those challenges did get filed at the Supreme Court, meaning the justices could consider them. But to slightly oversimplify, the justices, including the three that President Trump had put in place, rejected those appeals from the Trump side. It's reported from the White House that the president was surprised that even his three appointees to the Supreme Court did not take his side. And then we look at the score, you might say. How many votes were cast in the United States? Very high voter turnout. President Trump is proud to say he got 74 million votes, more than any candidate in the past. But what Mr. Trump doesn't mention is that his challenger, former Vice President Biden, got 81 million votes, 7 million more than Mr. Trump got. So, Emily, considering that rate of participation and the passions, I guess the passion for politics that exists in this country, do you think Joe Biden probably wants to calm everything down, that that's one of his goals?
Oh, absolutely. And I think part of the promise of his campaign was, you know, that America is back. But I think our crises, both foreign and domestic, are going to prove difficult or are going to make it difficult for him to do that. Do I think that he will send out fewer tweets and certainly less and have less inflammatory language? Yes. Do I think that he will put forth policies that are in his mind intended to reunite the nation? I do. There are millions of people who do not believe that he's the legitimate president. There are other millions of people who think, I don't want to go back to normal at all. Normal wasn't good for me. We are still in a pandemic. We're in an economic crisis. I think it's going to be very difficult to tell people it's okay, just be calm.
Just be calm. Well, that's a watchword for Washington, D.C. as we head into the big transition on January 20th. By the way, it was noticed that on the same day that the members of the Electoral College confirmed Joe Biden's victory, within minutes, we heard from the White House that Attorney General William Barr is resigning. He'll be leaving the administration. Barr had that job as Attorney General 30 years ago. He came back to be head of the Department of Justice 2 years ago. And Barr seemed to be a very loyal supporter of President Trump. But lately, the president went sour on Bill Barr. Tom, how do you explain everything that happened with the Attorney General?
Dan, I think it's real simple. If you're not toeing the line with Trump on everything, you're no good. And basically, it's true. Barr has been extremely loyal and extremely supportive of just about everything President Trump has wanted him to do. There's a long list, but I think at the end of the day, a few weeks ago, Barr said, we've examined the question of voter fraud and voter irregularities, and we don't find any. That's a paraphrase. And the reporting out of the White House is that Trump just went ballistic. I mean, here's the president still saying this election was stolen from me. It was rigged. And Barr is on the record saying the Justice Department found no evidence of anything like that. And that's more than enough to put Trump into an uproar. And that, I think, was the end for Barr. The real question was, once that happened, the question was Trump going to fire him, or was there going to be a way to work it out so that Trump would not fire him, but he could leave? There were intermediaries here working on behalf of both parties, but in the end, the chief lawyer at the White House brokered a deal where Barr would come in and drop off a letter of resignation, which was 2 pages long, and almost all of those 2 pages were super supportive of Trump. You would think Trump was Trump was Mother Teresa, Mahatma Gandhi, and a few other people. It was so fulsome in its praise of Trump, and I think that was how it happened. He soured on Barr. He wanted to fire him. Trump was talked out of firing him, so they had what I would call a shotgun divorce that apparently, at least on the surface, was all hugs and kisses, but Trump is still angry at Barr.
We also will discuss reports from U.S. government officials here that several agencies have been hacked. The hackers are alleged to be working for Russia. And of course, the latest on the coronavirus after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman. Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. And our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
As President-elect Joe Biden forms his cabinet, almost all the people will require confirmation by the U.S. Senate. We see an effort to represent this country, not so many white men, to be frank. And Pete Buttigieg, he is a white man, a Democrat who ran for his party's presidential nomination. If he does become Secretary of Transportation, if the Senate agrees, then this former mayor from Indiana, Buttigieg, he would be the first openly gay person to be confirmed by the Senate for a cabinet post. Emily, when we think about Buttigieg, some of the other selections, the choices that Biden is making, they seem significant.
Yes, they are significant. They are historic. I think on transportation in particular, there's a frustration from some in the country that domestic cabinet positions or transportation, for example, or housing and development for another, that they become political rewards instead of going to people who really know about housing or transportation. But Buttigieg, you know, had a good record on urban development in South Bend, so we'll see how this goes for him. On the issue of representation, I would just say that I think what many people will be looking for is what these historic and significant picks do, what kind of policies they enact, or rather how they act to change and shape policy for a more diverse country, right? So that it's not just the cabinet that's diverse, but policies serving a diverse America.
Of course, keep in mind that Joe Biden's vice president will be Kamala Harris, who's been a senator representing California. For the first time, a vice president of the United States who is a person of color. Her father, a black immigrant from Jamaica. Her mother was an immigrant from India. Now, Tom DeFrank, such things do make a difference when a new administration wants to connect with the broad variety of people who make up the American society.
Well, that's true up to a point, Dan, but we can't forget that I still think there's about 35 to 40% of the country who are still passionately devoted to Donald Trump. And I would say at least a third of those think the election was stolen from him. So it's going to be hard to reach what I would call the hardcore of Trump's hardcore. But I mean, there's no question that the cabinet that Biden is putting together, assuming they all or most of them get confirmed, is a more diverse cabinet than Trump had, and it's a good start on diversity and reaching out. On Buttigieg, I think it will be interesting to see how he can succeed in what one of the main purposes of Transportation Department is, and that's infrastructure. Everybody knows that roads and highways and ports and airports are crumbling. They're in bad shape, and we need tens of billions of dollars. Some would say a couple of trillion dollars on infrastructure fixes. We in the country are running massive deficits because of the economic decline and the pandemic. And that's going to be Buttigieg's greatest challenge, to see if he can help Biden figure out a way to get some important infrastructure projects done through a very divided Congress.
Let's turn to another subject, high-level hacking. Officials here in Washington say computer systems at the Pentagon, that's the Defense Department, the Treasury, and the Department of Homeland Security were penetrated by hackers believed to be Russians. Russia denies that allegation. Emily, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, Russia has not accepted many allegations. The system that we used to prevent these kinds of attacks was called Einstein. And perhaps this is a lesson in not tempting fate. You know, the New York Times is calling this the greatest intelligence failure in recent history, both because the hackers designed it to evade Einstein's attention and because the U.S. intelligence community, in fairness, was focused on protecting the election. This has been going on since the spring. It was only recently detected. And we don't know yet, I don't think, what the consequences of this hack are.
Now, unfortunately, we've got to discuss the COVID-19 pandemic. In many countries, this second wave, and some places are calling it a third wave, is worse than things were this past spring and then in summer. Just one example, South Africa. Officials say holiday parties have meant that folks are getting together indoors, many not wearing masks or keeping their distance from each other, as though they're waiting for the new vaccines to take care of everything. But until enough people can get the shot, the numbers of hospitalizations and deaths keep climbing. That's the story almost everywhere on this planet. Tom, it was heartwarming, emotional a few days ago to watch the first nurses and doctors in America get the vaccine made by Pfizer and BioNTech. A follow-up dose has to happen 3 or 4 weeks later. All this TV coverage, folks getting their shots. Tom, it's like finally having a weapon to fight back in this war.
It seems, Dan, it feels like this is the beginning of the end, but it's only the beginning. And experts, scientific experts, are saying, don't get cocky, don't let up on precautions, because we're still talking a minimum of 6 to 9 months, or maybe even all of next year, before everyone in the U.S. who needs the vaccine will have the vaccine. This is good news. It's very good news. It's, as I said, the beginning of the end, hopefully. But there's still a question whether there's going to be how quickly enough of these doses reach the average person. Obviously, the priority is going to be healthcare workers, first responders, critically ill people or elderly people in nursing homes. And then you've got to go to people who are over 65 with the medical conditions that make them very vulnerable, like heart problems, diabetes, other things. And that's going to take a while. But I think by the end of February, the situation will be better. But on the other hand, the daily death rate in this country is now over 3,000 a day, every day. This is more than it was at the height of the pandemic in March. And we're not that far away from a huge amount of holiday traveling over Christmas. And it's pretty clear now that the tens of millions of Americans who traveled over the Thanksgiving holiday at the end of November were creating a super spreader event, and we're probably on the verge of another one of those.
Tom, as we headed into the weekend, official figures showed more than 1,650,000 people around the world have died from COVID-19. The United States has the highest death toll, more than 308,000 people dead, more than 100,000 being treated in hospitals right now. And the hospitals are overwhelmed by all this work. Now, when President-elect Joe Biden announced that he would get the vaccine shot in public on TV, President Trump didn't make clear right away what he would do. Don't forget that he was ill briefly with COVID-19. So Mr. Trump has said that he has immunity now. He did say this. He wants to be sure that Biden is not given credit for defeating the virus. Opponents of Trump insist that he did a terrible job with a lack of organized leadership in fighting coronavirus. But the White House says the president pushed health companies and researchers to do their work in so-called Operation Warp Speed and come up with these vaccines. Billions in U.S. government money went to that. Emily, does it make a difference? Who should get the credit?
I'm sure it makes a difference to them. The Trump administration does deserve credit for Operation Warp Speed in that it allowed pharmaceutical companies to manufacture to scale normal times would not have done. So that the vaccine is going to be available to as many people as it is, as soon as it is to the Trump administration's credit. That being said, the Trump administration has, I mean, I don't consider this to be a partisan statement, has badly mishandled this pandemic, denied for months that it was a problem, encouraged people to disobey their state's stay-at-home orders. So while they can take credit for the manufacturing or for the production of the vaccine, they can get credit for how this pandemic has gone, is how I'll put it.
Some of the policy people at the White House say that they always had to think about the economy. So the so-called shutdowns in various states were so bad for the economy that that affected people's health. And, well, that's the reason that they suggested the balance they did. In general, Republicans were against, quote, shutdowns of schools and businesses. And Democrats felt that those shutdowns were necessary. In general, it became partisan. I'm also thinking about the World Health Organization, part of the UN, which reports it does not have enough money to make sure that developing countries get enough vaccines and medicines to fight COVID all around the world. The rich will benefit from vaccines before the poor do. Perhaps that is the way of the world. It reminds us that under President Trump, the U.S. this year left the World Health Organization, saying it's dominated too much by China, and supposedly the WHO was covering up the start of this coronavirus in China around 1 year ago. Tom, do you expect the Biden administration will rejoin the WHO as well as the Paris Climate Change Accord and perhaps other multinational deals such as trying to negotiate a new version of the Iran nuclear accord that President Trump walked away from? This new era could affect health, international relations, and so much more.
Yes, Stan, absolutely on all three of the items you just mentioned. Biden, his aides have said they are going to rejoin the Paris Accords on the environment. They are going to resume membership in the World Health Organization and will contribute the money that the Trump administration cut off to the WHO. They're going to do that, and I suspect they will do that, some of that on day one or day two of the Biden administration. So all those things will be a quick reversal. The president doesn't require legislation to allow him to do that. He can sign an executive order and make those policy changes with the stroke of a pen, just as President Trump, with the stroke of his pen, changed a lot of policy immediately in January of 2017. So I think that's going to be a change. It'll be controversial, but I think most people generically will support a lot of that, but not all. Not all of Americans will support it. This is still a very polarized country.
Thank you, and happy holidays to all our listeners and to our panelists, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to The National Journal. This program is produced here in Washington by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravitz.
VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Earlier this year, the internet rumor mill buzzed with claims that the sun was heading into a long and deep period of dormancy because of a lack of observed sunspots. Over the past couple of months, the story has morphed into an apocalyptic scenario which predicts that the sun was about to enter something called a grand solar minimum, with decreased solar activity that could last for years. This, in turn, would plunge the Earth into a mini ice age with constant freezing temperatures, possibly causing famine and other devastating natural calamities. As the rumor spread online, scientists, including those from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, reassured the public with facts that the sun wasn't going into an extended period of inactivity or a grand solar minimum, and that the Earth wasn't headed for another mini ice age. One thing the rumor did spark was curiosity about solar activity and something called space weather. So today we'll talk with an expert to learn how the sun goes through periods of high and low activity, which is called the solar cycle, and about space weather. My guest who joins us today via Skype is Douglas Biesecker, a physicist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Prediction Center located in Boulder, Colorado. Doug, I understand that the sun goes through a roughly 11-year period of activity called a solar cycle. What is it?
A solar cycle can be measured in many ways, although they all show the same 11-year period that you mentioned. The standard way we've been measuring a solar cycle for hundreds of years is to count sunspots. And in those 11 years, you have solar minimum when you have almost no sunspots, to solar maximum when you can have many, many sunspots.
Can you tell us what exactly is a sunspot? So how sunspots are generated? What do they do?
Sunspot is the thing you would be able to see if you could look at the sun with your naked eye. Don't recommend doing that, by the way. Do not look directly at the sun without proper protection, such as eclipse glasses. In fact, this morning, there is exactly one sunspot on the sun. It's so small, even with eclipse glasses, you wouldn't be able to see it. But sometimes there are sunspots that are so large, you can see them with your naked eye. And the reason you can see it is because they appear dark compared to the rest of the sun around it. Sunspots are cooler than the rest of the sun by about 500 degrees, and that's because they're regions of intense magnetic field that prevent some of the heat from the interior of the sun from getting out in that narrow region where these intense magnetic fields are.
What do sunspots have to do with solar activity and the solar cycle itself? Why are they so closely aligned?
So that alignment happens because of this fact that they are magnetic fields. They're showing us a picture of the strength and location of the solar magnetic field. And where it's strong, it produces solar activity that we monitor here at the Space Weather Prediction Center for solar flares, what we call coronal mass ejections, and other sorts of activity that are all associated with the intense magnetic fields and the energy that that releases. And that's why we see an uptick in what we release in terms of forecasts, watches, and warnings at solar maximum as compared to solar minimum.
And I definitely want to get into talking about space weather in a bit, but let's get back to the solar cycle. It's normally, as we mentioned, it's normally an 11-year cycle, but have there been unusually long or short cycles?
The average solar cycle is 11 years. It can vary by up to a couple of years, shorter or longer. It has in the past. So having a cycle that's 12 years or a cycle that's 10 years isn't anything that unusual. It's just that the average over the last 24 comes out very close to 11 years. Having said that, the intensity of this cycle, like how many sunspots we get at solar maximum, can vary from cycle to cycle as well.
A few scientists and internet activity recently suggest that the sun has been very quiet for the past at least 2 years, and there has been a little over 100 days this year when there were no sunspots at all observed on the sun. By the sun being quiet or little activity, what does this mean?
When there is very low activity, it generally it means there's a much lower risk of solar storms impacting the Earth. When we divide space weather into all of its sorts of phenomena, one of those does include high-speed solar wind. And the high-speed winds don't come from these sunspot regions. Instead, they come from what we call coronal holes, which are actually more numerous at solar minimum. And so from an impact perspective, solar minimum is a big concern for people that operate communication satellites at geosynchronous orbit, for example, can be impacted by these high-speed winds, or really the electrons in the environment of the satellite that are affected by the high-speed solar wind.
Doug, I understand that we're transitioning from one solar cycle to another solar cycle, and that because of the very little sun activity that we're in a solar minimum. However, word started to spread on the internet that the next solar minimum would be like few before it, some suggesting that the sun may be entering what is called a grand solar minimum. First of all, what is a grand solar minimum compared to a regular solar minimum?
A grand solar minimum doesn't really have a definition because, as far as we're aware, there's only been one, what we call the Maunder minimum. But in general, what we would expect if people are talking about a grand solar minimum is that we would go 20, 30, 50 years with no sunspots or very, very few sunspots on the sun.
So when was the last time? When was the one time that we had a grand solar minimum?
The one grand solar minimum that we're aware of, known as the Maunder minimum, occurred in the late 1600s from about 1645 to 715. So about a 60-year period where sunspots didn't disappear completely from the sun, but were very few in number without any evidence for a maximum in the cycle or a minimum in the cycle.
Doug, I understand a lot of people connect the grand solar minimum with what is called the Little Ice Age. Do you see that?
Yes, that's something that has been a connection that was made when Europe in general saw cooler than average temperatures for an extended period of time. And so that did get associated with the Maunder minimum. And of course, the sun plays a role in our temperature on the Earth. The impact of that is well understood. We know how much solar radiation we're receiving. In fact, the total amount of radiation coming from the sun changes by less than 1%. So even from minimum to maximum, what matters for affecting temperature on Earth is almost constant, and it changes just a tiny, tiny fraction. But there are measurable impacts of that tiny change in solar output.
So does it look like we're in for another grand solar minimum, and as some people are saying, another ice age?
There's very little evidence that we are expecting to go into a grand solar minimum. In fact, there's sort of two points to make here. One is there wouldn't necessarily be any evidence that we were about to go into a grand solar minimum. As far as we can tell, solar cycles behaved normally right up until the Maunder minimum happened. And then there was no way to know when it was going to end until it ended and sunspots started reappearing. So that's at least what we know from surface observations. Maybe if we were to observe one now, when we have a better understanding of what's happening inside the sun, we would have some method of predicting this. So having said that we don't know, what we do know is by looking at the magnetic fields on the surface of the sun and the transport of those magnetic fields underneath the surface, using something we call helioseismology, so just like seismology of earthquakes tells us about the Earth's interior, we do seismology on the sun that tells us about the interior of the sun. And we see the evidence for solar cycle 25 now in those data. And as far as we can tell, everything on the sun is behaving normally. The forecast for cycle 25, based on all the data we have, is for cycle 25 to be below average in intensity, but a healthy solar cycle.
Wasn't solar cycle 24 also kind of weak?
So cycle 24 was also kind of weak. And by that, what we mean is in the last 100 years, or, you know, count, and now we're talking solar cycles. So in 100 years, you get 10 cycles, well, nine really. And of course, being the lowest out of, you know, 10 maybe isn't that big a deal. But cycle 24 was below average. Our forecast for cycle 25, and this forecast was put together by an international panel that included researchers and forecasters from not every country in the world, but from representatives covering the globe from Japan and China to European countries, in the case of the UK and Germany and others in Europe and in the US. So it's a consensus, at least on the panel, that cycle 25 will be about the same as cycle 24 in intensity.
Do we feel effects of a solar cycle, like when there is minimum solar activity versus maximum solar activity?
So the average person, and by the way, I consider myself an average person, living at home, doing my normal things, no way, I cannot tell that there's a solar cycle. There is no impact on my life. And that's the way, that's good, right? Mm-hmm. Because in some ways that means we are doing our job. Having said that, certain industries feel the impact. And in extreme cases, people in places like Quebec, Canada, in Sweden, in South Africa, have had electrical power problems caused by space weather. There have been airline communication problems caused by space weather. If you use GPS for very high accuracy uses, by that I mean centimeter, then you're susceptible to space weather.
When was it discovered that there is such a thing called solar cycles? Because I understand it goes way back at least to the 1700s.
So in the late 1700s, we started to get consistent observations of the sun, enough that people were observing the sun and trying to count the sunspots almost every day. Prior to about 1750, people would notice sunspots on the sun. Occasionally, people would spend some time to count sunspots, but weren't doing it very regularly. So in the mid-1700s, around 1750, that started to happen. Observatories started taking regular counts of sunspots on the sun. And after 30 years of that, it became clear that, oh, hey, there's a solar cycle of about 11 years.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. If you have access to the Internet, please check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel VOA for alerts and program updates. Today, on the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we're talking about how the sun works and something called space weather. My guest who is joining us via Skype is Douglas Piesecker, a physicist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Prediction Center, located in Boulder, Colorado. Doug, I'm curious. I can understand tracking, measuring, learning all about the solar cycle with today's technology, but how were they able to do so back in the 1700s? How were they able to determine it? What technology was in place then?
So the technology was a simple telescope, typically with a filter or by projecting the image of the sun onto a piece of paper so that you could draw what you're seeing. In fact, you literally would trace what you see. And there's a semi-famous example of this. In 1859, an observer, Sir Richard Carrington, who was a hobbyist solar observer, but a serious one, he observed the sun every day about the same time of every day and would project a telescopic image of the sun onto a piece of paper and trace what he saw. Well, what happened in 1859 was he was in the middle of doing this, and all of a sudden, while tracing the sunspots, a bright feature appeared in the middle of his sunspot. And at first he thought it was a problem with his filter, some pinhole or something, but it was evolving. He actually noted the time that this occurred, drew a picture of what it looked like, ran off to find somebody to confirm it. By the time he got back, it was fading and almost gone. And so, in fact, he was observing a solar flare as it happened, but the sunspots, because they're there all the time, meant no matter when you looked at the sun, you could see those and draw images of that. So we have, or there are images of the sun and the sunspots on the sun, you know, going back many hundreds of years.
And I understand the technology that was used back then. And of course, here in the 21st century, we have all kinds of technology. We have spacecraft. We have more sophisticated telescopes. Can you tell us, Doug, what tools do you use to track the activity of the sun?
So when we're interested in tracking the activity of the sun for space weather, we're using satellites. We're using ground-based telescopes. We're using things that work at many wavelengths. So on the ground, we have optical telescopes, we have radio observatories. In space, we have instruments that are measuring the X-rays from the sun and the ultraviolet from the sun, those things that don't penetrate our atmosphere, that give us a picture of the sun, its surface and its atmosphere, so that we have all sorts of details about not just the sunspot, but the magnetic field, and what is happening in terms of the solar flares and the coronal mass ejections and these coronal holes that are on the sun. But the counting of sunspots essentially happens the same way today that it did 200 years ago.
We were talking about a grand solar minimum. Is there such a thing as a grand solar maximum? And if so, has it ever happened?
I guess the short answer is no. One thing that's gotten a little confusing with the solar cycle is that about 5 years ago, the count of sunspots changed. And that's a very long story, but I think I can tell it briefly. So it turns out that the first person to really count sunspots had a set of rules for how he counted. And we have to have rules for everything. Oh, that spot only lasted for 30 minutes. Do I count it? Today we would say, no, we don't count things that don't persist for very long. What about something that is very small? What about the technology or the capability of the telescope they were using at the time? And so were they missing some small spots that they might have seen with a slightly better telescope? So it turns out the original counts of sunspots were low by a significant factor, about 40%, based on the rules that were being used. And it turns out then for about 250 years, we kept that scaling factor, even though we knew that a true sunspot count was really higher if you used modern counting rules. So about 5 years ago, the official center in Belgium for counting sunspots made the decision to go ahead and correct the sunspot number so it reflects the modern counting rules for sunspots. There were a bunch of other little effects mixed in doing that. So there was a large effort by the community to go back and literally even find the telescopes used, you know, hundreds of years ago to see how good they were, but also to assess the rules that any observer was applying in calculating sunspot number. Until 5 years ago, there was a wide belief that cycles really 17 through 23, so sort of the modern era, were much larger and a long period of very high activity. But when they went back and recalibrated the old numbers, it sticks out a lot less. And in a sense, it evened out the sunspot cycle quite a bit, so that there really isn't, and at least this is my opinion, I wouldn't refer to any period as a modern maximum, and there's certainly no widespread acceptance of a modern maximum.
We've touched upon the solar cycle itself, and we've mentioned space weather a bit. Let's talk a little more about that, if we could. Can you define what space weather is? When we think of weather here on Earth, we think of sunshine, clouds, rain, snow, hail, so forth. What is space weather?
So space weather is the variability of the sun on short time scales. So here we're not talking about the solar cycle timescales or climate change timescales, but literally on timescales of seconds, minutes, days, and hours. And so we are monitoring the sun with satellites and telescopes continuously 24/7 for eruptions of solar flares, of coronal mass ejections, for evidence of the coronal holes that are going to give us high-speed winds, so that we can issue accurate forecasts and issue the warnings to customers when these occur that they need to take action.
Doug, from what you're saying, it seems as though the sun itself is the sole component of space weather. Is that true?
That is mostly the case, that the sun is the sole factor for space weather. The only variation on that is if humans are going to go to a place like Mars, what your biggest concern for that is radiation levels. And radiation from the sun is only one component of that. It's what we call galactic cosmic rays. These are highly energetic radiation particles coming from outside our galaxy even, are a bigger concern. The thing is, our sun, when it's at its maximum of activity, which you would think would be when radiation is at its worst, actually shields our environment from these galactic cosmic rays. Not completely, but it shields enough of them that it's a noticeable difference. And so from a radiation perspective, traveling to other planets, you would go when these cosmic rays are a minimum, which happens to be at solar maximum. But otherwise, from our perspective, all space weather concerns here on Earth are related to the sun.
You're talking about cosmic rays, and of course we talked about the effect of the sun on the Earth, and along with the sun protecting us somewhat from cosmic rays, what about Earth's magnetic fields? What impact do Earth's magnetic fields have on space weather?
So the Earth's magnetic field is really the thing that protects us from the particle radiation, the galactic cosmic rays and similar but lower energy radiation from the sun. So under normal conditions, the magnetosphere of the Earth, the Earth's magnetic field, protects us from this radiation. However, it's disturbances in this magnetic field caused by the high-speed winds or by the coronal mass ejection impinging upon the Earth that causes space weather. And the way to think about it is it's a magnetic field. And those of us that have played in a laboratory with magnets and wires to try to light a light bulb or generate an electric current in the wire by moving a magnet, that's what's happening in the Earth's atmosphere during what we call a geomagnetic storm, basically causing the Earth's magnetic field to vary both in intensity and direction. And then this drives electric currents in any sort of conductor, like the power grid or oil pipelines. And so that's, in fact, a very simple way that the magnetic field of the Earth both protects us from radiation, but then generates the impacts of space weather. Now, geomagnetic storms are only one of several types of space weather that we monitor. Solar flares send photons, basically light, X-rays and ultraviolet, out in massive bursts, that they affect the ionization of the atmosphere. And the reason that's important, for one, is if you use GPS, well, you're a GPS receiver, and you probably have one if you have a cell phone, if you might have a GPS in your car. That's communicating with satellites in space, the GPS or Galileo or BeiDou, depending on which country you're in. Networks, to calculate your position, you have to know the exact distance between you and the satellites. But the signal from the satellite has to go through the Earth's ionosphere, and that means it doesn't actually follow a straight path. And so you have to know all the details of the ionosphere between you and the satellite to accurately determine your location. Your receiver, every GPS receiver unit has a model that does that correction for you, but it does that correction based on there being no space weather. When a solar flare happens, to change the ionization of the ionosphere, the satellite ends up appearing to be in a different place, and that gives you an error in your location because the model in your GPS receiver doesn't realize that the Earth's ionosphere has changed. It's only temporary. It might only last a few seconds to minutes, but if you're doing something with GPS at that time of high accuracy, it could be wrong.
I've read a couple of studies over the past couple of years that some scientists are speculating that Earth's magnetic field is actually decreasing. And on another hand, I understand also that the poles of the magnetic field are about to flip. Can you comment on both the weakening of the fields and the flip of the polarity of the magnetic fields?
I've probably read the same studies that you're referring to, which is the extent of my knowledge. Yes, there is clear evidence that the Earth's magnetic field has weakened ever so slowly over, you know, the past 100 years, for example. Not to the extent where it makes a big difference for space weather, though. Now, what that means for the flipping of the polarity of the Earth's field, what happens during the flipping of the field, I don't know anything about that. My understanding is that we don't really know how the flipping of the field works. But I think there's widespread belief that the Earth's field is always there. If the field disappeared completely during the flip, there would be evidence of the increase in the cosmic rays that would be impacting the Earth.
Doug, again, can you tell us why it's so important that we have a Space Weather Prediction Center, why we should be paying attention to space weather?
We're paying attention to space weather because it's making sure that the lights are staying on in our houses and in our places of employment. Commerce today is using GPS to do amazing things, from building roads to farming, that all depend on knowing when a space weather storm is happening. So there are huge elements of our economy related to the power grid and GPS, but even aviation. While we've been serving airlines space weather information for many decades, a brand new service for global aviation started in November of last year, where three global centers that are about to be four are coordinating forecasts for the airlines to make sure that radiation concerns, GPS concerns, and communication concerns of the airlines are all being alerted of all of that activity so they can take appropriate action.
Doug, thank you so much for taking time to join us today and for filling us in on solar cycles and space weather in general. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Rick. And anytime you want to talk space weather, feel free to call.
That was Douglas Biesecker, a physicist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Prediction Center located in Boulder, Colorado. He joined us today via Skype. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today. And please be sure to join Carol Castillo again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Berman. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Saturday announced a stay-at-home order.